This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Apple for the Teacher. My name is Anna Thomas. Today's episode follows on from the two previous episodes about the disappearance of Walter Collins. Episodes 212 and 213, called Chameleon. In those episodes, we saw that a man reported to police that he thought he had seen the missing boy. He saw the face of a boy whose body had been wrapped up in a newspaper, and he recognized the face as belonging to the missing boy, Walter Collins. The police noted how this sighting appeared to be similar to another child who had also disappeared in Los Angeles. Her name was Marion Parker, and she had been abducted and held for ransom. She was eventually found also wrapped up in a newspaper, but she was deceased. So these two crimes made police believe that the perpetrator was the same person. Now, in the last episodes about Walter Collins, you listened to a radio play that was made about his story back in 1951. Back then, there was a radio series called Dragnet, which featured real crime stories. Walter's case was one of the stories featured. The radio series ran on NBC for 8 years between 1949 and 1957, with a total of 314 episodes, all about crime cases which had occurred in Los Angeles. And then it continued on as a television series. The series followed the exploits of a group of Los Angeles Police Department detectives, led by an officer named Joe Friday. As well as Walter's case, I also found that Marion Parker's story had also been featured on Dragnet. And as I had previously covered her story, I thought I would replay the original episode, followed by the Dragnet radio play. The Dragnet story of Marion Parker is called the Sullivan Kidnapping. The real names of those involved were changed, as were some of the details, but it is essentially the real case of Marion Parker. So listen now to my original episode, followed by the Dragnet radio play about the story of Marion Parker. For this story, we go back almost a century to the year 1927. The Parker family lived in Los Angeles, California. Perry and Geraldine had three children, a son and twin daughters, Marion and Marjorie, who were 12 years old. Perry worked as the chief clerk at the First National Savings Bank in Los Angeles. The twin sisters attended the Mount Vernon Junior High School. It was December and only a few weeks away from Christmas. Marion was at school enjoying her class Christmas party when she was then called to the school office as she was being picked up early. But she was surprised as her parents hadn't told her that she would be going home early. She made her way to the office and expected that her twin sister Marjorie would be there as well, but she wasn't. Only minutes earlier, a man had entered the school office and spoke to the secretary. He said he had come to pick up Marion early, as her father had been involved in a car accident and was in the hospital. The man said he worked at the bank with Marion's father. Normally, it was school procedure for students to be released only to authorized persons, but the man offered for the secretary to phone the bank to confirm his identity and story. However, she didn't feel this was necessary, and Marion was permitted to leave with the man. She was quite upset, knowing that her father was injured, but the man tried to comfort her, saying, "Don't cry, little girl. I will take you to your daddy." It was only after Marion and the man left that the secretary remembered her twin sister Marjorie. So she decided to call the family at home and see if they wanted her to come home as well. A man answered the phone and introduced himself as Perry Parker. Yes, the secretary was talking to Marion's father himself, who supposedly had been in hospital. She was confused, asking if he had been in an accident and if a man had been asked to come and collect Marion from school. But Perry knew nothing of what she was talking about. She told him the man's name, but no such person worked at his bank. Perry then rushed to the school, so relieved that Marjorie was still there. She told him she had seen her sister walking with a man, but had no idea who he was. The family was in a panic, but that night they got some answers to their questions. A telegram was sent to their house informing them that Marion had been kidnapped for ransom. It said, "Marion is secure. Use good judgment. Interference with my plans, dangerous." And it was signed by George Fox. Perry didn't know anybody by this name. And then the next day, a special delivery letter arrived at the house, which said, "Fox is my name. Very sly, you know. Get this straight. Your daughter's life hangs by a thread, and I have a Gillette ready and able to handle the situation. Fulfilling these terms with the transfer of the currency will secure the return of the girl. Failure to comply with these requests means no one will ever see the girl again except the angels in heaven. The affair must end one way or another within 3 days, 72 hours. You will receive further notice." And the letter was signed, Fox Fate. So the police were called, who started questioning everyone at the school, and their house was put under surveillance and their phone line was tapped. Perry then received a second ransom letter instructing him to collect $1,500 in $20 gold certificates. And there was also a letter from his daughter Marion, which read, "Dear Daddy and Mother, I wish I could come home. I think I'll die if I have to be like this much longer. Won't someone tell me why all this had to happen to me? Daddy, please do what this man tells you or he'll kill me if you don't. Your loving daughter, Marion Parker. P.S. Please, Daddy, I want to come home tonight." Perry then received a phone call from the man, and here is what he said. "I am the Fox. Have you the money? I am some distance away. I will phone you again in a few minutes and give you your instructions." 30 minutes later, he phoned back and said, "I am the Fox. Give me your word as a Christian gentleman that you will not try to trap me." He then told Perry where to go to exchange the money for Marion and added, "And come alone. Dim your lights and don't bring any police if you want to see your child alive." Perry didn't hesitate to gather the ransom money and proceeded to the location that the man had indicated, desperate to get Marion back safely. The police also surrounded the location, careful to keep out of sight. However, no one arrived to collect the money, and Perry left without his beloved daughter. He was panic-stricken that he may have missed his opportunity to get Marion back, and feared greatly for her well-being. Perry then received a new ransom letter instructing him to deliver the money to a new location. He threatened that Marion would be killed if he did not come alone this time. The letter said, "Death approaching nearer each and every hour. When I asked you over the phone to give me your word of honor as a Christian and honest businessman, not to try to trap or tip the police, you didn't answer. Why? Because those cars carefully followed your car and then proceeded to circle the block. Mr. Parker, I'm ashamed of you. I'm vexed and disgusted with you. With the whole damn vicinity throbbing with my terrible crime, you try to save the day by your simple police tactics. You'll never know how you disappointed your daughter. She was so eager to know that it would only be a short time and then she would be free from my terrible torture, and then you mess the whole damn affair. Your daughter saw you, watched your work, and then drove away severely brokenhearted because you couldn't have her in spite of my willingness, merely because you, her father, wouldn't deal straight for her life. If by 8 p.m. today you have not received my call, then hold a quiet funeral service at your cemetery without the body, only God knows where the body of Marion Parker would rest in this event. Not much effort is needed to take her life. Pray to God for forgiveness for your mistake last night. Become honest and be square with me. That's all. Signed, Fate Fox. And a letter from Marion was also included, which read, Dear Daddy and Mother, Daddy, please don't bring anyone with you today. I'm sorry for what happened last night. We drove right by the house and I cried all the time last night. If you don't meet us this morning, you'll never see me again. Love to all. P.S. Please, Daddy, I want to come home this morning. This is your last chance. Be sure to come by yourself or you won't see me again. Marion. Then Perry received another letter which read, P.M. Parker, please recover your senses. I want your money rather than to kill your child, but so far you give me no other alternative. I'll give you one more chance. Get the money the way I told you and be ready to settle. Be sensible and use good judgment. You can't deal with a mastermind like a common crook or kidnapper. Set no traps. I'll watch for them. You know that when you play with fire, there is cause for burns. Get this straight. Remember that life hangs by a thread and I have a Gillette ready and able to handle the situation. Do you want the girl or the gold certificates in US currency? You can't have both and there's no way out. Believe this and act accordingly. Before the day's over, I'll find out where you stand. I am doing a solo, so figure on meeting the terms of Mr. Fox or else. And then the letter gave Perry detailed instructions as follows. Final chance. Death final chance terms. Have $1,500 in gold certificates in US currency. When you go to the place of meeting, you will have a chance to see her. Then, without a second's hesitation, you must hand over the money. The slightest pause or misbehavior on your part at this moment will be tragic. Seeing your daughter will take a moment. My car will then move slowly away from yours for about a block. You wait, and when I stop, I will let the girl out. Then come and get her while I drive away. And don't go slow this time. And don't attempt to follow when you get the girl. Be sure and wait till my car pulls up ahead and stops, and you see me put the girl out before you start up. Don't act excited or think that I will run away with Marion. I will do as I say, and I hope to God that you will have the sense enough to do exactly as I have said. Well, it's not to worry me if you blunder again. I have certainly done my part to warn and advise you. Signed, Fate Fox. This time, Perry decided not to inform the police. He arrived at the location, and just as the man described, a car pulled up next to his, and he saw Marion sitting in the front passenger seat. The man had his face concealed and then took out a shotgun, which he aimed at Perry, saying, "You know what I'm here for? No monkey business." Perry called out to Marion, but she didn't respond, with the man saying, "She's asleep. Give me the money and follow instructions." So Perry handed over the money and then followed the vehicle. Next, he saw the man toss something out of the car. Perry was frantic, hoping beyond hope that he hadn't tossed his beautiful daughter out of the car. But when he stopped his car and approached the bundle on the road, he soon realized that indeed it was his precious girl. As he lifted her up, her body seemed limp and lifeless, and it didn't take Perry very long to come to the horrific realization that Marion was dead. And now I need to provide a warning that what you will hear next is extremely disturbing, so you may wish to skip ahead. When Perry lifted his daughter off the ground, her arms and legs were missing, with only her head and torso remaining. She had been disemboweled and towels had been placed inside her to fill the empty spaces. A wire had been fixed around her neck and brought up behind her head and secured to her forehead in an attempt to prop her head up. Her eyelids had been sewn open to make it look like she was alive. The autopsy examination concluded that she had been dead for about 12 hours, but it didn't appear that she had been sexually assaulted. It was difficult to determine the exact cause of death, but it was narrowed down to blood loss or asphyxiation. The detective who arrived on the scene gave the following account of what had happened. Quote, "I walked up to Mr. Parker and asked him where the little girl was, and he said, 'There she is, sitting in the car. Go and look at her. God bless her little heart.' And he could talk no more, and this friend of his had to take him away. So I immediately went over to the car, and the little girl was sitting with her little head leaned over to the right. And the first thing that attracted my attention was the thread that was fastened over each eyelid and across the forehead and right back over the head and down the neck. I made an examination and lifted the body up and told Inspector Taylor that all of the body wasn't there. He came over and made an examination and talked to Parker and searched the automobile. And when the coroner came, I carried the body out of the automobile and put it in the wagon, and we came on down to the morgue with it." Perry had managed to give police a description of the vehicle, although it drove away too fast for him to get the license plate. The car was eventually found abandoned, and the police were able to determine that it had been stolen. Fingerprints were then taken from the car, and then, after checking police records, they found that the prints belonged to a man who had been known to the police after committing a number of other offences. Fingerprints found on the ransom letters also matched the man's, and the man's fate was ultimately sealed when they discovered he was a resident of the Bellevue Arms apartments. The police also inspected the towel found inside Marion, and a mark on the towel led them to determine that it came from the Bellevue Arms apartments. In the man's apartment, they found bloody footprints and ransom letters that had been discarded in the trash. There was also newspaper clippings of Marion's kidnapping. The police then released the man's photo to the media, and he was dubbed America's Most Wanted. There were many sightings of the man, and police were able to follow his trail. He also used the gold certificates from the ransom while on the run, which made it easier for the police to track him. So the man's luck finally ran out, and he was found and taken into custody. When his photo was broadcast to the nation, it came as a shock to discover that the man was only 19 years old. The police conducted a background check on the man, and it was found that he had an extensive criminal record, mostly for petty crimes and robberies. As he didn't have regular employment, he had to resort to crime. However, he did manage to get a job working in a bank, and that bank was where Marion's father worked. But it seems the man was not capable of earning an honest living, and it was discovered that he had forged checks at the bank. He was convicted of fraud, and then after serving his sentence, he asked Perry to have his job back at the bank, which of course he refused. The man then continued to commit robberies, but he then had the desire to commit a crime that would pocket him a very large amount of money and decided that he would kidnap someone for ransom. He then recalled that Perry Parker had twin daughters, and thus the idea to kidnap Marion was born. After he had been apprehended, he made a full written confession as follows. Quote, "During the past 6 months, the idea of kidnapping a young person and holding it for ransom came to me as a means of securing money for college. On December the 12th, I decided to locate Mr. Harry Hovis, chief teller at the First National Bank, and to arrange to take his young child. But I wasn't satisfied with the situation. I then thought of Mr. P.M. Parker, because I had seen a young girl with him one day at the bank while I was employed there as a page. On December the 14th, I drove over to Mr. Parker's house and waited to see him drive home and his daughter return from school. The next day, I was again parked near the Parker residence in my car, which I had stolen. About 8 o'clock, I saw two young girls leave the Parker home and followed them to the Mount Vernon Junior High School. I entered the attendance office and asked for Parker's daughter, saying that her father had been in an accident and wished to see her. The young girl did not hesitate to come with me, and we left the school immediately. I stopped the car in a quiet street and told Marion that she had been deceived. I told her that I would have to hold her for a day or two and that her father would have to give me $1,500. Marion did not cry out or even attempt to fight. I explained to Marion what a chance I was taking. I warned her that she would be hurt if she tried to get away, and I showed her my .38 automatic. I started the car and we drove to the main post office, where I mailed a special delivery letter to Marion's father. Marion sat right up in the seat beside me and talked in a friendly manner. It was very nice to hear her, and I could see that she believed and trusted me for her safety. He then goes on to describe how they went back to his apartment, and he said that she went to sleep immediately, and then the next day she was sobbing and wouldn't eat breakfast, so he tried to console her and said that she could write a letter to her father. He then went and posted his second letter and her letter, but before going he said, "I tied Marion to a chair while I was gone, but used cloth bandages, and she was not cut or bruised in any way. I did not blindfold or gag her, and she promised to keep quiet. I told Marion all along that I would have to make things look worse to her father than they really were, so that he would be eager to settle right away. Marion knew that I wrote her father that I would kill her if he didn't pay me, but she knew that I didn't mean it and was not worried or excited about it. In fact, I promised Marion that even if her father didn't pay the money, I would let her go back unharmed. She felt perfectly safe, and the tragedy was so sudden and unexpected that I'm sure she never actually suffered during the whole affair, except for a little sobbing." He then went on to describe the murder in graphic detail, which I will not repeat. So, here is what the man said about his motive for the murder. Number one, fear of detection by the police, and the belief that to kill and dissect the body, I would be able to evade suspicion and arrest. Number two, Marion had a strong confidence in me for her own safety, and I considered her own wish to return to her father too deeply. However, my desire to secure the money and return to college were even greater. Number three, even though my habits have always been clean, and although my high school record is commendable, I have had an uncontrollable desire to commit a great crime. This feeling borders on the edge of insanity. So, let's now get into the man's trial. The prosecution argued that the man acted out of greed when he kidnapped Marion, and that he was seeking revenge because Perry wouldn't give him his job back. The defense argued that his actions were the result of a man who was insane, and he then became one of the first people to make use of a new California law which allowed offenders to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. However, the prosecution were able to find evidence that seemed to show that the man was not insane. Before the trial commenced, the man had written a note to a fellow prisoner, and here is what it said. Quote, "Listen, Dale, I believe you and I can trust you. All the depositions aren't enough to prove me insane. I've got to throw a fit in court, and I intend to throw a laughing, screaming, diving act before the prosecution finishes their case, maybe in front of old man Parker himself. P.S. You know and I know that I'm not insane, however." They also found out that the man had asked the prison guards to tell him how he could act and look crazy. However, his plea of insanity was not successful, and he was ultimately found guilty of kidnap and murder. Here now is the judge's statement at the sentencing. "It is the judgment and sentence of this court that for the crime of kidnapping, the offence described in count one, that you, blank, be confined in the state prison of the state of California. The court finds that the degree of the crime in count two is murder of the first degree, and that for that crime of murder, you shall suffer the penalty of death in the manner provided by the laws of the state of California. and may God have mercy on your soul. He was then held at the maximum security prison, San Quentin, awaiting his execution by hanging. His defense team made a number of appeals, even going all the way to the Supreme Court, but these appeals failed, so the man's execution was upheld. While he was awaiting execution, the man then became a devout Christian and started writing letters to anyone he had committed crimes against, apologizing for his actions. He also addressed the media, saying, quote, "I want no young man to study my crimes. My life has been deplorable. I think the publicity given to crooks and crimes has a bad influence. It should be given to men and women of high purpose who deserve it." So the man was placed into position for the execution. However, the hanging did not go according to plan. He slipped when the trapdoor opened and hit his head while falling. An autopsy would reveal that his neck did not break. Rather, he had slowly strangled, much the same way as Marion Parker had died. So many believed that justice had now been served. So there's really nothing I can say about this story. I didn't give you all of the details, but you could see from what I did tell you that it was absolutely horrific. And all those times that he kept on saying, "Oh, she trusted me and she was in good spirits and we went to the movies together and we had a jolly good time," we all know that that's absolute BS. He's just tried to make himself just look like such a hero, but we know that he never treated her as well as he said. He was an outright, I don't know, there is no word to describe that man. There's just no way to describe him. So back when this horrific crime occurred in 1927, the case gripped the nation and it became infamously known as, quote, "the crime of the century." But it was then drowned out 4 years later when a young boy was kidnapped who was the son of Charles A. Lindbergh, the well-known American aviator. The boy's body was eventually found and the U.S. Congress then passed a law making kidnapping a federal crime, and the FBI became the lead agency in kidnapping in the U.S. So what happened to the Parker family? Marion's father died at age 65 and her mother died at age 75. Her twin sister Marjorie got married and then died at the age of 71 in 1987. So what a sad, sad story. Yes, I know that I have covered sad stories on my podcast, but in this case, I have spared you the details of what poor Marion went through. As I always do, I look for photos of the stories that I present, but it just broke my heart that there are photos on the internet of Marion's body with her arms and legs removed. I just really wish that there was a law that prohibited the publishing of crime scene photos. This is something that no one needs to see. Now, if there is anything good that can come out of this story, it could be the fact that Marion's body parts were found the next day in a park and the family decided to cremate their little girl. I have seen a photo of the cremation urn, which has been interred in a cemetery mausoleum. A mausoleum is a building that holds the remains of one or more deceased people above ground. After funeral services, the body is placed in a small room within the mausoleum, just large enough for the casket. The room is called a crypt, and the process of placing the casket in the crypt is called entombment. Marion's urn is inside a glass-enclosed crypt at the Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale, California. So what about Marion's school? It was completely rebuilt and had its name changed to the Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Middle School in 2006. But they kept a large stone from the original school building, which is still located in the school grounds near the entrance. It was carved with the school's original name, Mount Vernon Junior High School. So if you'd like to leave Marion a message on the Find a Grave website, you can find her under the name Marion Parker. And now let's preview the next episode. It's called Gone Girl. The Pope made a plea to help find Emanuela. So, was she ever found? And to end this episode, rather than finishing with a quote, I'd like to finish by playing a ballad called The Murder of Little Marion Parker, which is believed to have been recorded not long after her murder. It was written and sung by a man named Vernon Dowhart. How precious that this recording still exists almost 100 years later. So I hope you enjoy it. Bye for now, and remember to be a good apple.
In a town in California lived a happy family. They had a blue-eyed daughter, and her heart was filled with glee. Her mother used to kiss her as home from school she came, and everybody loved her. Marion Parker was her name. One day, as little Marion went gaily on her way, a cruel and heartless villain took the child away. Her parents were heartbroken, the nation held its breath, and then they found the poor girl, her body cold in death. Hunted for the slayer, the fiend who take the blame, and soon they caught the villain. Young Hickman was his name. They brought him back to justice. His heart was cold as ice. And for this fiendish murder, he had to pay the price. There is a mighty teaching that we should all obey. It is the Ten Commandments we should follow night and day. The story of poor Marion is one we all should learn. We all should guard our loved ones. They may leave and never return.
Here's another in NBC's great parade of new shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
NBC brings you Dragnet. Sergeant, you're assigned to homicide detail. A 22-year-old girl has disappeared. A letter has been received. It demands $30,000 for the girl's return. The letter is signed, The Wolf. Your job, get him.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. Investigated and solved by the men who unrelentingly stand watch on the security of your home, your family, and your life. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Tuesday, October 18th. It was cloudy in Los Angeles. We were working the night watch out of Homicide. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on the way back from the stats office, and it was 3:26 a.m. when I got to room 42, Homicide.
Got those mugs you asked for, Joe. Here they are.
Thanks, Harris. Backstrand leave yet?
In a minute. I'm going out with him. What's the address out there, the Sullivan Place?
814 Castro Boulevard. You go straight out Santa Monica, take a left at Castro.
I remember. You ready, Chief?
Yeah, man. Friday, you call Romero yet?
Right now.
Get on it. This one we don't fool with.
Yeah.
Come on, Harris.
Sorry to wake you, Ben. This is Joe. How are you feeling?
Oh, hi, Joe. What time is it?
3:30 a.m. How do you feel?
Oh, a lot better. Be back to work tomorrow.
You'll be ready in 20 minutes. I'll pick you up.
20 minutes? Okay, what's up?
You remember Martin Sullivan, vice president of the Third National Bank?
Sullivan? Yeah, what about it?
He's got a 22-year-old daughter. Or he had one. She's gone.
Good time, Joe. Where are we headed?
Sullivan home out on Castro Boulevard. Ed's out there now with Harris.
Any leads to work on?
No, nothing so far. The girl disappeared a little before 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. At 11 last night, he got a letter. They want $30,000.
Sullivan hasn't got that kind of money.
Yeah, I know it. Poor guy's almost out of his mind.
Fill me in. How'd it happen?
Well, the guy took the girl out of business school. He had her called out of class. Told her father was sick, said he was a friend of the family.
Well, how about the teachers? What was their story?
Said the girl didn't want to go with the man at first, but he finally talked her into it. Kept telling her father was dying.
That's about as low as it come?
Yeah.
Did he use a car?
Witnesses said it was a blue sedan. They didn't get the license number or the make.
Did they remember what the guy looked like?
About 5'9", 160, brown suit, dark hair.
Nothing else?
No. Here's a copy of the letter. The usual. Read it.
Yeah. I have your daughter, Judy. What's that?
$30,000.
$30,000 quick if you want her back alive. Don't call police or I'll kill her. Contact you later. Signed, what was it?
The Wolf.
Oh, Wolf,
I could think of a better name. Come on, here we are.
Who's got the original note, Joe?
Lee Jones down at the crime lab. He's checking it for prints and handwriting.
Well, if he was... Oh, hi, Dave.
Yeah, right on the house, boys. Just waiting for you.
Thanks, Dave.
Hi, Joe. Ben. In the living room.
Thank you.
That's the way I see it, Mr. Sullivan. Now, you understand exactly what you have to do?
Yes, sir. I'll do as you say.
All right. Here are the two men who will help you. Sergeant Friday and Sergeant Romero, Homicide.
Yes, sir. How do you do?
I do.
Mr. Backstrand, are you sure about all this? He might get frightened. He might do something to Judy.
Believe me, Mr. Sullivan, it's the only way. I know how you must feel, but we can't do anything else.
All right, I want to see Mrs. Sullivan first. I'll be ready in a moment.
Any developments?
Yeah. Come on back in the dining room. There it is on the table. Second note from the guy.
Telegram.
When did this come?
About half an hour ago. Guy phoned it into Western Union from a public booth. Couldn't trace it.
I see, Joe.
Yeah. Be at Elysian Park, 5 o'clock this morning, near Balkan Drive. Come alone. Bring 30,000. Will return girl. Don't tell cops. Kill her if you do. The Wolf.
4 a.m. now, Skipper. Not much time.
I know it. We'll have to do as he says. No other way.
Then Sullivan's going out there alone?
You're going with him, you and Romero. You'll be hidden out in the trunk of the car.
Any plan?
Get him. That's all.
Ben and I went out the back door and into the Sullivan garage. We jammed ourselves into the trunk compartment, and Harris closed the door on us. The latch was fixed so that the door could be pushed open from the inside. A few minutes later, Mr. Sullivan came out, got in the car, and we drove off. At 5:03, we pulled up at the meeting place in Elysian Park. We waited. Nothing happened. At 5:05, it started to thunder.
That's all we need now. Thunderstorm.
Stuff in here in this trunk, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Ben, listen. Up and down alongside the car, doesn't it?
Now, listen. Can't hear anything yet. Can you?
No. We better stay undercover.
Yeah. The rain's starting in. Wonder what happened to the wolf.
Cold feet, maybe. Let's wait it out.
Time you got now?
Move over a little to me and my watch.
Yeah.
A little past 5:30.
Sergeant. Sergeant.
Mr. Sullivan?
Yes. Do you think he's coming? Please. It's getting daylight.
We better wait it out, Mr. Sullivan. Now look, don't come back here again. If he's watching, you might tip him off.
Oh, all right. All right.
Poor guy. Coming up the road toward us.
It's stopping.
Yeah. Coming over to our car. You ready?
Right. Talking to Sullivan.
They're coming back here. Now watch it.
Brandy, Romero.
That you, Ed?
Yeah. The meeting's off. Come on out.
All right.
I got a cramp in my leg.
Well, I'm cramped all over.
Mr. Sullivan, drive back home. We'll contact you there.
All right, Chief.
Ben, Joe, come on over to the car.
What's the story, Ed?
The guy had no intention of following through with this meeting tonight.
Well, how come?
He told us. Phone at 5:00. Tried to trace the call. He wouldn't stay on the line long enough.
What did he have to say?
He wanted more money. Bragged about how smart he was. How we'd never get him.
But he knows Sullivan's called in the police.
Sure. Said he didn't care. We'd never get him anyway.
Yeah, pretty cocky.
Pretty smart. Take my word for it. He's no dummy.
Control 1 to 80K. Control 1.
I'll get it. 80K to Control 1. 80K to Control 1. Go ahead.
80K, go to your office, code 3. Go to your office, code 3. GMA 367.
All right, Romero. Let's roll.
More than 12 hours had passed since word of Judy Sullivan's disappearance had been phoned in a homicide. During that time, an all-points bulletin containing the descriptions of the suspect, his car, and the girl had been sent out on the teletype to law enforcement agencies throughout the area. The same descriptions were broadcast over the police radio every hour. The Sullivan home had been placed under strict surveillance, and Mr. Sullivan instructed not to contact the suspect without knowledge of the police. He'd raised almost $10,000 in cash to buy him off. The serial number on each one of the bills had been copied by a police stenographer and then rechecked by a homicide officer. So far, the wolf, as he called himself, had made 3 separate contacts, but he'd covered his tracks well. We knew that he was somewhere in the city, 500 square miles of it, and we knew we had to find him fast. It was 6:18 when we got back to homicide.
Hi, Chief. Fellas.
You got something for us, Mac?
Here, this letter. Special delivery. Came in about 25 minutes ago.
Can I see that, Mike? Stay away from Sullivan. If the kid's found dead, it's your fault. Stay away, the wolf.
All right, Mike. Get it over to the crime lab and have Lee check it for prints.
Right, Chief.
Lee find any prints on the second note, Mike?
2. Running through R&I now.
Friday, Romero. Get down there and see if they got a make.
Right, Ed. Let's go, Ben.
Who's watching the Sullivan house beside Harry?
Carpenter and Davis. Backstrand's afraid the girl's father will try to make a deal with the guy.
Has he tried it yet?
No, he hasn't yet. You couldn't blame him if he did. Worried sick.
Oh, yeah.
Here we are.
Hi, fellas. Just coming down to see you. Got something, Larry?
Those 2 prints Lee Jones listed off that letter. Got a make on them from the single print file.
Good, Larry. Let's see, huh?
There it is. Pull the whole package on them. Donald Alfred Kiefer. Looks like a real bad one, doesn't he?
Donald Alfred Kiefer, male, Caucasian, age 29, 5 feet 8 inches, 170 pounds, brown eyes, dark brown hair. He had one previous arrest for forgery in Los Angeles 10 months before. Kiefer's occupation at the time of his arrest was listed as bank clerk at the Third National Bank. Ben went back into the files and pulled the crime report. Then we called Ed Backstrand.
There's the answer, Skipper. At the time Kiefer pulled that forgery job at the bank, Mr. Sullivan was one of the vice presidents.
Go on.
Sullivan was the one who preferred charges against Kiefer and saw that he was prosecuted.
Where's this Kiefer now?
Let me see. He's placed on probation, and on May 16th this year, he returned to his home in Omaha, Nebraska. That's 1380 Mackinac Avenue.
All right, Romero. Get Omaha on the phone and have them check out Kiefer.
Right, Skipper.
Friday, take Kiefer's package and this note down to Don Myers. Have him check the handwriting. And get over to the crime lab and see what Jones lifted off that last letter we got.
All right, Ed.
The faster we work, the faster we'll put this guy behind bars. Now move.
How's the writing compared, Don? What'd you find?
Yeah, it looks good. See here? Slants as crosses, double loops as L's, open A's, pressure on the downstroke. Donald Kiefer, Wolf, same handwriting.
Lifted three prints off this last note, Joe. Brought them out with the iodine fume gun. They match with the first.
Thanks, Lee. Did you find anything else?
I don't know if it'll help you much. We examined the paper for watermarks and texture. Both notes are written on the same kind of paper. Impressions show both pieces of paper from the same tablet. Check the density of the carbon and the pencil he used. Both specimens match. Same pencil.
By mid-afternoon, Donald Kiefer's description had been broadcast throughout the area. Bulletins were dispatched to all departments, and an APB was teletyped for the entire state. Men were stationed at every post office in the city to watch for notes that might come through the mail. The bus depots, railroad terminals, the airports, and all the main roads leading out of the city were under strict surveillance. The entire Los Angeles area was broken down into single square-mile districts, and a house-to-house canvas was started. A squad of men were assigned to cover each square mile. Outlying towns and cities were requested to do the same. By 5 o'clock that afternoon, the greatest dragnet operation in the history of the city was underway. We were sure Donald Kiefer was somewhere inside. At 12 minutes past 5, Ben got the call back from the Omaha police.
Yeah, I got it. 6X-ray 419. Nebraska place, right. Well, thank you a lot. Yeah, bye.
They had a make on the car.
Lots more. The Omaha cops are looking for Kiefer, too. Won him for a robbery there 2 months ago.
Yeah?
In that robbery, he used a stolen 1939 blue sedan. Nebraska license plate, 6X-ray 419.
How about his family and his friends back there? They all been checked?
Yeah.
Well, get that car description, the communications, huh? APB, teletype, and broadcast. I'll tell him.
Yeah, right, Jim.
Right in, Romero.
Yeah, Ed.
What are you tied up with?
Well, just got a call from Omaha. Make on Kiefer in the car.
Give it to me. You two get out to the Sullivan house fast as you can. T. Harris.
What's happened, Skipper?
Martin Sullivan's disappeared.
Harris, how'd it happen? About 3 this afternoon, Mr. Sullivan got a phone call. Said he had to go down to the bank. I went with him. He had me wait in the reception room, and he went in his office. After waiting 10 minutes, I got suspicious and went in. He was gone. That's it.
Did he get any more money?
This morning, $5,000.
Did you get the serial numbers off the bills?
Yeah. Shouldn't have let him get out of my sight.
Forget it. Right now, we've got to find out where he's gone to meet Kiefer.
Did you talk to Mrs. Sullivan about it, Harris?
She says she doesn't know anything about it.
Let's try her again. Come on, let's go inside.
Hi, fellas.
Hi. Where's Miss Sullivan, Dave?
Back in the sitting room, lying down. Doctor's with her.
Come on. What time you got, Ben?
6:35.
I'll get it. Hello? Where are you? Oh. Where are you now? Where are you now? We'll be right out. That was Martin Sullivan. He met with Kiefer up in Laurel Canyon.
Did he get his daughter back?
Yeah. Wrapped in newspapers. All cars in the area were notified that a contact had been made with Kiefer. We got in the car and drove out to Laurel Canyon. The entire area had been blocked off. We found Martin Sullivan standing in the middle of the road at the end of East Winding Way. 500 feet down the hill was a private residence where Sullivan had telephoned us. It was the only building in the immediate vicinity. A few yards beyond the point where East Winding Way ended, back in a clump of tall grass, we found the body of Martin Sullivan's daughter. We notified the crime lab. Chief Backstrand in the corner. Despite a severe state of emotional shock, Martin Sullivan tried to tell us the story.
He said Judy was all right. I believed him. I wanted her back. Judy. I tricked the officer, the one watching me. He said, come alone, no police.
Did you see his car, Mr. Sullivan?
I wanted her back. I wanted Judy back. I did as he said. I drove here at 6 o'clock and I waited. I put the money on the front seat, like he said.
Did he get the money, Mr. Sullivan?
And I got out, left parking lights on. I stood up there by the end of the road, waiting.
Mr. Sullivan?
And he drove up. He took the money. Then he came up to me. He had a gun. I wanted to shoot him back. He had a gun.
Did you see his car?
He said she was up there, beyond the road, tied to a tree. I wanted her back.
Mr. Sullivan, did you see his car?
I went to look for Judy. He drove away. She wasn't there. By the tree. Couldn't find her. On the way back, I saw her bundle on the way back. Let me find it. Kill her. Let me find it.
Before he went into a state of complete collapse, we showed Martin Sullivan a picture of Donald Alfred Kiefer. He definitely identified him. The information was immediately relayed back to Central Division, rebroadcast to the entire police radio system. A teletype was dispatched to sheriff's offices, and communications were sent to police stations throughout the country. The house-to-house search throughout the entire city intensified. The dragnet in which we hoped to trap Donald Kiefer was drawing slowly inward. It was 12 midnight.
Street, Sullivan girl murder, next street. Read all about it. Citizens join search for killer.
Friday, did the papers get a list of the numbers on that ransom money?
Yeah, it got them in the final night edition. 2.5 pages of serial numbers gave it a big spread.
Look at these pictures of Kiefer here, all over the front page.
The more the better, Romero. I hope this town never forgets that face. Good reminder. You don't make deals with killers.
Hi, fellas. Come on over.
Find anything yet, Lee?
Just checking over these towels here. Found them wrapped around the girl's body, inside the papers. Funny thing about those papers.
What's that, Lee?
They're all yesterday's. Every story about the girl's disappearance has been clipped out.
Maybe the guy's making up a scrapbook.
How about the towels, Jones? Any laundry marks?
Not a one so far, Ed. Every one of them was clipped off. Pretty smart. The morgue post the body in?
They're doing it now.
Yeah, nasty one.
Yeah. Did you get any footprints or tire marks out where they found the body?
Lots of them, all cast. Bossy and Taylor are checking them. Not one thing.
What is it, Jones?
I don't know. Under the seam here, this towel. Wait a minute. Joe, that pair of snippers there.
Yeah, here you are.
Thanks. That's back under the seam. There. That's one tag he missed.
Any markings, Lee?
Yeah. Greenway Apartments, Los Angeles.
One look at the apartment was enough. In an adjoining garage, we found the car which Kiefer had used, a blue sedan. Nebraska license plate 6X-ray 419. When we got back to the office, Chief Backstrand immediately issued a cancellation of the warrant order for the blue sedan, and then he ordered a detail of men to stake out the car in the event Kiefer decided to come back for it.
Here's the coroner's report, Joe.
Oh, let's see it. Yeah. Cause of death, strangulation. Time of death, Monday, October 18th, approximately 2 p.m.
1 hour after he grabbed her?
That can't be right.
Skipper in his office?
No, he's out for a minute.
Hey, Joe, Ben, take the call off 2503, will you?
Thanks, Mike. Right. Would you give me the call on 2503, please? Thanks. Hello? Yeah. Yeah, when? We'll be right over. Some of the ransom money, Ben, just showed up. Beverly and Highland. Come on. The man's name was Ralph Donahue. He operated a used car lot on the corner of Beverly and Highland. He told us that early that morning he sold a dark blue late model coupe to a man who gave his name as Fred Sims. The man paid for the car in cash. Donahue told us that he checked the serial numbers on the bills after the man had driven away.
Serial numbers check out, Joe, every one of them.
If I only thought to look, officer, and you know I generally do. I'm the suspicious kind anyway, but, oh, this morning I must have been asleep.
You got the full description on the car, Ben?
Yeah, Joe.
All right, let's get it on the air right away.
I saw his mug in the paper while I was waiting for you. Too late. Sorry.
Yeah, thanks. At 3:10 that afternoon, another piece of the ransom money turned up at a busy downtown department store. The clerk was unable to remember who gave her the bill. The detail throughout the general downtown area was strengthened. The house-to-house search of the entire city for Judy Sullivan's murderer went on. The afternoon dragged into the early evening. At 7:20, Ben and I had a hamburger and a cup of coffee in the drugstore at East Broadway and 3rd. And then we got back in the car, checked with communications, and started cruising the neighborhood again. At 8:09, a man answering the description of Donald Kiefer was seen crossing Sunset Boulevard just below Highland. 7 minutes later, the same man was reported near the intersection of Hollywood Boulevard and Las Palmas. Communications relayed the information. At 8:21, our car, 80K, along with a dozen others, were concentrated in the Hollywood Boulevard area from Gower Street to La Brea, Franklin Avenue to Santa Monica Boulevard. At 8:24, another piece of the ransom money was passed at a cigar store on the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Hawthorne Street. The number of men and radio cars in the area was redoubled. Plainclothes officers were stationed at every intersection to keep an eye on pedestrian traffic. At 8:09, the dark blue coupe which Kiefer had bought that morning was spotted parked in an alley just below Hollywood Boulevard and Coenga. We called Ed Backstrand.
City Hall.
2503.
2503.
Chief of Detectives Office, Hannah.
Is Friday Mike, Chief, there?
Yeah, wait a minute. Just going out the door. Ed, it's for you. Backstrand.
Friday, Ed. Just spotted Kiefer's car, the one he bought this morning, parked in an alley off Coenga.
Harris and I are on our way up there now. We'll take care of the car. You take care of this call. Just came in.
What do you got?
The theater on the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Fairview. The girl in the box office just took in a $10 ransom bill.
Yeah?
She got a good look at the man who passed the bill. She says it's Kiefer.
Ben, come on.
Yeah. You've got the list of serial numbers?
Right here. Let's check at the window.
Yes, sir. How many, please?
Police officers. Sergeant Romero, Sergeant Friday.
Oh, yes, sir. Mr. Rayburn, the police are here. Would you step around to the side door, Sergeant?
Yes, ma'am.
Margie, relieve Francis for a minute. Francis, come here. Bring that $10 bill with you.
Sharp girl, officer, that Francis. Sharp.
Here it is, Mr. Rayburn.
All right, Sergeant. There you are. $10 bill and the list of serial numbers.
Check out all right, Ben.
That's it, Joe. Good work, man.
You reported the man came in about a half hour ago. You're sure it was Kiefer?
Yes, sir. I have his picture in the box office just behind the change machine. I recognized him right away.
And as far as you know, he hasn't left the theater.
That's right, sir.
All right, Mr. Rayburn. I'm sorry. I'm afraid we'll have to interrupt the show.
Anything you say, Sergeant. Anything.
Ben, you keep an eye on the front exit. I'll call communications.
All right, Joe.
80K to Control 4. 80K to Control 4.
80K, go ahead.
Control 4, clear all frequencies. The Sullivan murder suspect, Donald Kiefer, has been located in the theater on the southeast corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Fairview. Have all units surround the area.
80K, roger. Attention all units. Attention all units. Assist 80K at the theater on the southeast corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Fairview. The Sullivan murder suspect has been located in the theater. Go ahead, 80K.
Control 4. Have all units converge in the general area, Hollywood Boulevard and Fairview. Unit 62R to block off the intersection at Hollywood Boulevard and North Cherokee. Stop all pedestrian and vehicular traffic. Unit 61A to block the intersection at Hollywood Boulevard and Hudson Street. Stop all pedestrian and vehicular traffic. Unit 71 and 72R to block the alley behind the theater. Unit 66 and 67R to assist at main entrance to the theater. Within a few minutes, the one-half-mile area around the theater was completely blockaded. Every exit and entrance to the theater was covered. At 9:23, we met Harris and Ed Backstrand in the theater manager's office. Backstrand outlined our plan of operation.
At 9:28, a detail of 14 men walked down the side aisles on the main floor of the theater and took up their posts on either side of the orchestra pit. The picture was stopped and every light in the theater was turned on. Ed Backstrand, Harris, Ben, and I went down the aisle and up onto the stage. Backstrand made the announcement.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're sorry to interrupt the picture, but this is important. We're police officers. We've traced the murderer of Judy Sullivan to this theater. He is in this theater now. Now we're going to search the theater row by row, and we'd like to ask your cooperation. There's no need to be panicky or afraid. Those who wish to leave now may do so. Leave by the main entrance. Each one of you will be checked as you go out the door. And for the benefit of the man we're looking for, don't try to escape. Every exit is covered and the entire area is blockaded. Don't place any more lives in jeopardy.
Come on, Ben.
Backstage, Joe. We can make it from there.
All right, let's go. Come on, hustle it, Ben.
Yeah. The next building. You'll probably try to jump for it.
All right, watch it. I think this door leads out to the roof.
There he goes.
All right, keeper, hold it.
Don't shoot. Don't shoot. I give up.
Throw your gun down. Over here.
Don't shoot. Don't.
Let's get him. All right, coppers. I got it figured. They won't top me for this. Didn't know what I was doing.
Put the cuffs on him, Ben.
Get away from me, you crumb. You shouldn't have hit him, keeper. Try the cuffs now.
Yeah.
Come on, let's get him in out of the rain.
What's the hurry?
Why spoil a good rain?
The story you have just heard is cruel. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
Donald Alfred Kiefer was tried and convicted of murder in the first degree. He was executed in the lethal gas chamber at the state penitentiary. You have just heard the 15th in a new series of authentic cases transcribed from official files. Technical advice for Dragnet comes from the Office of Acting Chief of Police, W.A. Wharton, Los Angeles Police Department.
Tonight's program is dedicated to Deputy United States Marshal John B. Glenn of Boise, Idaho, who on the morning of July 31st, 1940, gave his life so that yours might be more secure. Dragnet came to you from Los Angeles. Theater Guild on the Air returns tomorrow night on NBC.
So, what did you think of that? I think they did a very good job considering that this was made back in the 1950s. So if you go to YouTube, you will easily find the radio plays of Dragnet plus the television series as well. So if you're interested, you can go there and you can see many more episodes. So I hope you enjoyed that, something a little bit different. And that's all for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, and bye for now.